this year is by special request. Ooh. We're going to be doing something a little bit different than usual. Talking about a very fascinating chapter in history, which is the Vikuach HaRamban. That's the Ramban's disputation. So the story begins with...
What does that mean, disputation?
Debate. The story begins with a Yid named Pablo Christiani. That's a Shiddish name. I think his original name was Shaul. But he was a Meshumid. And he was a former yeshiva bachar who had become a Christian.
Wow.
And he had become joined the Dominican order, and he was very devoted to the ideal of converting Jews, bringing Jews over to the faith, to the, you know, showing them the light, so to speak. But he had, now that was an age-old challenge that the Christians had been working on for 1,000 years already, to try to convince the Jews or force the Jews, yeah, various methods to join their religion. But Pablo Christiani had an einfall. He had a new idea. Whereas until that time, the way it had always been done was with proofs from the Bible. What he said was that we're going to bring proofs from the Talmud. He said, he being a former yeshiva bachar, he knew that what most Christians didn't know, which was that the Bible was really not what the Jews were spending their V'higisa b'yom v'alayla on. They were, yeah, you know, we take it out of Shabbos and we read, you know, Kriyas HaTorah, yeah, we learn Chumash, but the life really revolved more around the Talmud than around the Bible. So that being a very important sacred text, so he said that he's going to prove the truth of the Christian faith from the Talmud. And that was something nobody ever tried before, and he believed that he had some really fantastic proofs that were irrefutable. And he was going to bring over the Jews in droves to his religion when he shows them these passages in the Talmud. Now, when he says Talmud, he means Talmud, Bible, Talmud, Yerushalmi, Medrash, Rabbah, any other Midrashim, all Chazal literature is what we're calling Talmud. And he said he felt that he's going to show people these things and they're going to start coming over in droves. But the poor guy found that it's not as easy as he thought. He was having a very frustrating experience. He would stop a Jew, or he would go into a synagogue and he would preach to the Jews, and he would tell them, look, it says in the Talmud such and such, maybe later on we'll see some of the proofs, it says such and such, that proves that you're all following the wrong religion, and come to me, I'm in the right religion. And on the one hand, you know, so if they would fight back, they would say, no, you could slug it up like this, so he would fight them back. But he wasn't getting that. It was more like a shrug, and people didn't really care. And he was very frustrated. Now, if you think about it, let's imagine that you're sitting on a train one day, you know, in the subway, and a guy walks over to you and he says, oh, I see you're Jewish. Yeah, let me show you something. He opens up a Bible. He says, let me show you this passage. And you see over here, it predicts the rise of Christianity. So you might read the passage. It's probably in Yeshaya. And say, well, okay, I never knew it said that in Yeshaya, that's interesting. But you're probably not going to, like, go follow him into the next church at the next stop to get baptized, because you'll think, okay, I never really learned Yeshaya, I'm not an expert on it, I'm not a Talmud Chacham, so he has, yeah, I'll call it a kasha, you know, from a kasha start from Nish. So there's a lot of things I have a kasha on, but I'm just an Amaritz. He should show my rabbi would probably know what to say. Or if not my rabbi, maybe my rabbi is, you know, has a more yeshivish background, doesn't really know the Yeshaya so well. Anyway, let him show it to a modern rabbi. You know, somebody out there is going to be able to answer his questions. I don't need to have all the answers. So that's why I think most people don't get so alarmed if they see Makayres that seem to question their faith. So that's what was happening here. Pablo Christiani was not getting anywhere with the Jews because they all thought, okay, that's an interesting kasha. He should ask my Rav, you know, but I don't have to have all the answers. So he realized that the only way to really make this work is if he goes straight to the top of the Jewish totem pole, go to the Gadol Hadar, and publicly bring these proofs to him, and he was very confident in his material, and demonstrate that the Gadol Hadar has no answers, and if he has no answers, then there are no answers, and then everyone's going to have to come and give in and concede. Now, the problem is, but how do you get the Gadol Hadar? Now, who's the Gadol Hadar at that time? He lived in Spain. There was no question that it was the Ramban. The Ramban was the towering figure in that generation, certainly among the Jews in Spain. And but Ramban had better things to do than to go enter a public disputation with this guy that was probably thrown out of his yeshiva 20 years ago. So what he did was, he went to the king. He went to the king, James of Aragon. Aragon was a kingdom in what we nowadays call Spain. At that time, there wasn't a country called Spain, but there was a few different kingdoms. Aragon...
Pablo went.
Right. So Pablo went to King James of Aragon, and he told him his big idea. And he said that this is going to be huge. You know, you're going to be... He was describing the glory that would...
What?
This is 1263. The glory that would redound to the crown, you know, you're going to go down in history as the king who, you know, who brought all the Jews under the banner of the church. That's going to be really great. And all you need to do, because I really have terrific material and nobody's going to be able to answer it. And he explained his whole strategy that he just needs to get the Ramban into a room with him in public. So I need you to call the Ramban and, you know, make him come. So the king said, sure. Now, and he summoned the Ramban. He told him he has to come to his palace in Barcelona. Now, the impression one gets from the various materials and documents that you could read about this is that James of Aragon was not like some of the monarchs at that time. That was, he was a, you know, very, very motivated by religious fanaticism or, you know, extreme piety, like, let's say, Isabella a couple of centuries later. He maybe, you know, thought that it would make good sport and probably be good for the economy. It would be a major event taking place. And so he liked the idea, but was approaching it with a surprisingly open mind. He called the Ramban and he said, okay, Rabbi Moshe, you have to come to Barcelona. You have to engage in this disputation. And he came. He responded to the summons and he arrived in the palace. And the very first scene in the disputation was probably the most important and most dramatic of all, in which he said, okay, you know what you're here for? You're hereby summoned to respond to the proofs of this priest that's supposed to prove from the Talmud that the Messiah has already come. And the Ramban said, okay, I agree to participate, but only if... And that already was a big chiddush. Like in most parts of Christian Europe, and you know, in history, a Jew couldn't say to a king, "Okay, but only if." But the Ramban with King James was able to get away with that, and he said on one condition, and the condition is that I get freedom of speech, complete freedom of speech. Now, this was utterly unheard of in the 13th century. This was a Christian country. And it was in a Christian country, it's a crime to speak out against Christianity. It's blasphemy. And blasphemy is a very serious crime, and you could get executed for that. So, but the Ramban said, okay, fine, you know, if we have to, you see, the way these things would typically go is that, you know, they would say ostensibly, yeah, everybody plays by the same rules. You know, you're both allowed to say whatever you want as long as you're both careful not to say anything critical of Christianity. So, but that's what the Ramban was coming lafuki from. The Ramban was saying that I'm not going to play under those circumstances. I have to be able to speak my mind about the matters. You know, if you want to just talk sports, we'll talk sports. But we're here to talk religion. I have to be allowed to speak my mind about religion as freely as the other side, both about my religion and about his religion, and otherwise I'm not participating. And James didn't want to lose him, right? He liked the idea, even though it was really unheard of at that time to allow somebody to speak freely, critically about Christianity in a Christian country. But he opened the door for this because he wanted the debate to take place. So he agreed. So the Ramban said, okay, so I agree too, and they had their disputation. So it took place over 3 sessions. It was spread out over the course of, I think, of about 10 days. It was 3 separate sessions. The official structure was that Christiani was supposed to be bringing the, you know, he was the plaintiff. He was supposed to be bringing the proofs, and the Ramban was the defendant. He was supposed to be responding to them. And then at the end of the, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, we'll go back, but at the end of the 3 sessions, when it was all over, there was a document written up which described the results, what happened at the disputation. Now, I have here, this document is a very official document. In fact, I'm going to start with the end, the signature. So it's a very, very impressive signature. We, James, by the grace of God, King of Aragon, Majorca, and Valencia, Count of Barcelona and Urgel, and Lord of Montpellier, confirm and acknowledge that each and every statement and action took place in our presence and in the presence of many others, as contained above in the present letter. In testimony of this, we have caused our seal to be appended as a perpetual memorial, and is followed by the royal seal. So it's a very impressive signature, attesting that this is a true and accurate account of what happened. Now, I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but I'm going to, this is translated from Latin, and I'm going to read excerpts. On July 20th, 1263, in the presence of the Lord King of Aragon and many other barons, prelates, clerics, and knights, in the palace of the Lord King at Barcelona, Moses the Jew, called Rabbi, was summoned from Gerona by the Lord King. Friar Paul, that's why I was calling Pablo, proposed to the said Rabbi that, with the aid of God, he would prove from writings shared and accepted by the Jews, the following, meaning from the Talmud, the following contentions in order, that the Messiah, who is called, I'll substitute Yeshu, whom the Jews anticipate, has surely come already. Also that the Messiah, as prophesied, should be divine and human. Also that he suffered and was killed for the salvation of mankind. That's 3. Also that the laws and ceremonials ceased and should have ceased after the advent of the said Messiah. In other words, that the mitzvahs don't apply anymore nowadays. So 4 things that he said he's going to prove from the Talmud. When the said Moses was asked whether he wished to respond to these contentions which have been indicated, he said and affirmed that he would, and that if necessary, he would remain at Barcelona for that purpose, not only for a day or a week or a month, but even for a year. Okay. Next paragraph. Then it was indicated to him that, in a previous conversation, he had conceded that if the Christians believed in the manner explained to him, this is talking about the Trinity, he would believe indeed that so it should be held. In other words, it was said that the Ramban had once agreed in a previous conversation that belief in the Trinity, the way it was explained to him, made a lot of sense. When this was repeated before the king, he did not contradict. Rather, he was silent, and thus, by remaining silent, he conceded. Right. Okay, in the next paragraph it says, then in the palace of the Lord King, the said Jew was asked whether the Messiah, who is called, I'll substitute Yeshu, has come. He responded with the assertion that he has not come. It was then proved to him clearly, both through authoritative texts of the law and the prophets, as well as through the Talmud, that Yeshu has truly come, as Christians believe and preach. Since he was unable to respond, vanquished by proper proofs and authoritative texts, he conceded that Messiah had been born in Bethlehem 1,000 years ago, and had subsequently appeared in Rome to some. When he was asked where that Messiah who he said was born and appeared at Rome might be, he replied that he did not know. It's not looking so good. Okay, on the next page, we're in the middle of a paragraph. It says, taking out of context, to this he was unable to respond. Later on it says, he then said that he would prove that the Jews had such and such, but was able to show nothing in these matters. Then there's a later on, they're talking about Parak Nun Gimel of Yeshaya, and I quote, although he, meaning the rabbi, consistently claimed that this passage in no way speaks of the Messiah, it was proved to him through many authoritative texts in the Talmud which speak of the passion and death of Yeshu, that they prove through the said chapter, which they prove through the said chapter, that the aforesaid chapter of Isaiah must be understood as related to Yeshu, in which the death, passion, burial, and resurrection of Yeshu is obviously contained. Indeed, forced by authoritative texts, he confessed that this section must be understood and explained as relating to Yeshu. From this, it is clear that the Messiah was to suffer. Okay, then in the final paragraph, which I'm going to read somewhat at length, since he did not wish to confess the truth unless forced by authoritative texts, when he was unable to explain these texts, he said publicly that he did not believe these authoritative texts, which were adduced against him, although found in ancient and authentic books of the Jews, because they were, he claimed, sermons in which their teachers often lied for the purpose of exhorting the people. As a result, he reproved both the teachers and scriptures of the Jews. Moreover, all these issues, or almost all which he confessed or which were proved to him, he first negated, then confuted by authoritative texts, and confused, he was forced to assent. Moreover, since he was unable to respond and was often publicly confused, and since both Jews and Christians insulted him, he persistently claimed before all that he would in no way respond, since the Jews prohibited him and the Christians, namely Friar de Yanoa and certain upstanding men of the city, had sent him messages advising him that he in no way respond. Concerning this, he was publicly refuted by the said Friar de Yanoa and by these upstanding men, whence it is clear that he tried to escape the disputation by lies. Moreover, although he promised before the king and many others that before a few he would answer concerning his faith and his law, when the said Lord was outside the city, he secretly fled and departed, whence it is clear that he did not dare, nor was he able to defend his erroneous belief. And then is the signature. So, that was Latin. In plain English, is given zu schmettert. Right? That's what this says, that he lost the debate in every possible way. He was confused. He was contradicted. The Ramban. That's what it says here. Right, absolutely. He couldn't find his way at all. He had nothing to answer to anything that they asked him. And he was embarrassed, and he was lying, and he ran away. So this is the official document, which has the seal of the king, and it was spread throughout the lands of Aragon and Barcelona and Aragon and Castile, publicizing what happened at the disputation. So if it was put up, you know, by the town crier in all the town squares, so eventually it was in Gerona, which is where the Ramban lived, and he came to shul one morning and maybe saw this, you know, settle on the table or hanging on the wall. Yeah, this Kilkerry.
Went viral.
Right, went viral, yeah. And he said, wait, that's not how I remember it happening. This doesn't sound quite like what I went through at all. So once this version was out there, he decided that he has to clear the record. So he then wrote his own version of the disputation. Now this is really, as you can see, it's just two pages. It's like an overview of what happened. He wrote an actual transcript, line by line. I said, he said, I said, he said, really presenting in its entirety a transcript of the debate. And
they didn't have a recording.
And that, right, they didn't have a recording, but they had... I don't know. If you have this document, and then you have his own transcript that he wrote, and then he publicized it, you know, meaning he had it copied and distributed and sent all around. So now, and all this happened in the year 1263. So we have here a very unusual situation. If you think of this from a historian's point of view, usually when you're trying to study an event that happened 700 some odd years ago, so the problem is a lack of documents, a lack of actual evidence from the time. You know, you just have hearsay, so it's hard to put together what happened so many years ago. Over here, it's the opposite. Over here, there's an abundance of documents. We actually have two documents that were written within weeks of the event, but they tell two totally different stories. Because, as we'll see soon, I have here some excerpts from the Ramban's version. It's not the whole thing. It's quite long. But the Ramban, in the Ramban's telling, he actually did quite well. He could be very proud of how he did in this disputation. So how do you reconcile the two versions? Now, obviously, for me, that's not, you know, that's not really a dilemma. The Ramban, you know, I know him and I trust him. If the Ramban says this is what happened, that's good enough for me. But let's put that aside. Let's suspend our trust and imagine that we were approaching this as a secular historian who has no skin in the game. He doesn't really care who won. He just wants to learn the history. He wants to know what really happened in Barcelona in 1263. Is there an objective way of figuring out which of these is the more accurate version? So according to the scholars that study this, there really is, because there's a third document, not about the debate itself, but a third document which is very, very telling. What happened was that after the Ramban publicized his version, he wrote it down and he publicized it, and as we'll see, you know, when we go through some of it, it really is, there are some very, I don't want to use the word nasty, but some very caustic comments in here about Christianity and about the foundations of their belief. He really takes them to task in a serious way. In other words, to use the word that you used before, Barry, it's blasphemy. What's written over here is clear blasphemy. The Ramban wrote it, and he was arrested. The police came, and they arrested him, and they put him on trial for blasphemy. And now that's a very serious crime. That's a very serious charge. He certainly, you know, could have been killed. He could have been thrown into a dungeon for the rest of his life. And his defense at the trial, obviously, we know what his defense would be. His defense was, but you said I'm allowed. You gave me freedom of speech. How could you now, accuse me or try me for what I did if you said that I'm allowed to do it? So the trial was held. There was a prosecution. There was a defense. And then there was a verdict. And we have... historians have the documents from this trial, and the verdict was he was found guilty. But he was found guilty on the grounds that permission to speak shall not be construed as permission to write. And so, which means, in effect, that he was caught on a technicality. He was caught on a technicality because, yeah, you were allowed to say, but you weren't allowed to write it. And his punishment, he was not executed, he was not imprisoned. His punishment was 2 years banishment from the land of Aragon, to which he said, thank you very much. That's a one-way ticket to Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, shalom uracha. That's which means that, considering what the charges were, was a slap on the wrist. So he was a conviction on a technicality, and the punishment was a slap on the wrist. So the historians say that if what, you know, this very impressive indictment of Christianity that he published was really a pack of lies, he didn't say any of this at the debate. At the debate, he was flustered and confused, and he couldn't really gather his wits. And on the contrary, the debate really showed the superiority of Christianity. And then he went and wrote a fantasy story demonstrating the superiority of Judaism. Then his defense was completely worthless. He had no defense for writing such a thing. The king gave you permission? The king gave you permission to participate in the debate, not to make up your own fictional stories blaspheming Christianity. So it's evident from this trial that they knew he was right, that he was really right, that everything that it says over here is exactly what he said in the debate, and the king had given him permission to say it, so they couldn't convict him of saying it. But on the other hand, what would be the optics if there's a trial of the church against the rabbi and the rabbi wins? That would be really bad. They needed to convict him, so they found Eppes a technicality, and they convicted him on that, and they gave him a slap on the wrist, and considered it done. So that's pretty strong evidence that what it says in his document is what really happened. So that, even from an objective, secular perspective, really corroborates the version that we're about to see. So with that hakdama, that's the hakdama. And now, let's take a look at, now that we're taking a look together.
Who was there again? Who attended this debate?
So there was the king and many other dignitaries. I think it says over here
Knights.
It says, right, among many other barons, prelates, clerics, and knights.
The king's men.
And the king.
Well, the king's
and, okay, this part I didn't read. And was present there along with many other Jews who seemed and were reputed among other Jews more learned. In other words, the Chash of Yidden. The Chash of Yidden were there too. It was in the palace. It was in the king's palace. Okay, so
there are witnesses.
Right, there are witnesses. Right, but they're gone. Right, but what we have now is the documents. The documents have survived.
I'm saying, but there shouldn't have been a card from them.
Okay, so the first round in the debate was that public Christianity said, okay, I'm going to prove from the Talmud that the Messiah has already come, and that therefore Christianity is the true religion. So Ramban said, okay, that sounds fantastic. Before I hear your proofs, I just want to have a clarification of what you mean to show. Because let's say you're successful and you demonstrate what you mean to demonstrate that there are passages in the Talmud that prove that Christianity is the true religion. So what would that mean? That should mean that the rabbis of the Talmud believe that Christianity was the true religion, which should mean that the rabbis of the Talmud were Christians. But the rabbis of the Talmud weren't Christians, right? The rabbis of the Talmud are after Christianity, right? Like he writes in this paragraph, you know, he says that Yeshu haye b'vayis sheni v'koydim chorban habayis noilad v'nerag. The whole story of Yeshu happened while the second base of Mikdash was still standing. V'chachmei HaTalmud, such as Rabbi Akiva v'chaveirav and Rebbe v'Rav Nosson and Rav Ashi, were all after the chorban habayis. So they wrote these passages, which you say demonstrates that Christianity is the true religion, and yet, heim hayu Yehudim va'omdu b'dasa Yehudim kol yemeihem, they, for some reason, didn't recognize the implication of their words, and they stayed Jewish, heim uvneim v'talmideihem, hashemim kol d'reim mipihem. So it seems, and he ends the paragraph somewhat sarcastically, that the rabbis of the Talmud didn't understand their words quite as well as you do. Only you were able to see that their words prove that Christianity is a true religion, but they who said those words didn't see that. So how am I supposed to understand what you mean to prove? Now that seems like a legitimate question that should get a response. The response was, you're stalling. You're just stalling because you don't want to hear my proofs. So he said, but I think I'm asking a legitimate question on the proofs that you're going to say. But then, you know, then the king said, look, you know, you said that you're going to listen to his proofs. So he said, okay, your majesty, I'm going to listen to his proofs. Okay. So then, skipping ahead a little bit, he brings a medrash. This is one of the best proofs. He brings a medrash. Now, this medrash we have, this is a medrash in Eicha Rabba. Friar Paul, Pablo Christiani. And in Eicha Rabba, it says that once there was a Jew who was plowing his field. He had his ox and he was plowing his field, and an Arab walks by his field and he says, Jew, untie your plow from your ox because your temple was destroyed. So the Jew untied his plow and untied his ox. And then it says that the ox gave a groan, and the Arab spoke up again, and he said, Jew, retie your plow and retie your ox, because the Messiah was born. That's the Medrash. That's the end of the Medrash. Ta-da! So you see? So what are we supposed to see exactly? So Paolo Cosciani said, so you see that it says in the Talmud that the Messiah was already born. And that's the Christian belief, because the Jews believe that Messiah is still in the future. And here it says the Messiah was already born. So Ramban responded somewhat dramatically. He said, well, I don't believe that story. But anyway, it's a proof to us. So right, he was deliberately being, like, you know, mysterious. And the other side all started to scream out, oh, what do you mean you don't believe the story? You know, this is from your books, right? You have to be prepared to defend your books. So the Ramban said, so then the Ramban had a discussion, and really it's this it's an aside in the debate, but it's a very yesidistic discussion. He's about the nature of agartas. And he was explaining to them, and the truth is that this was always a difficult point between the Jews and the Christians. You know, the idea that there was a holy book, but not everything is taken so literally. And, you know, if you're familiar with learning Gemara, if you learn Daf Yomi, certainly, so it's become second nature that sometimes you'll read a Gemara, and the Gemara will say something terribly strange, and you'll shrug your shoulders and say, okay, there must be some pshat in that, but we're learning fast now, okay? You know, so we go back there. What do you mean there must be some pshat in that? That maybe it means something like al derech remez, it's a metaphor. Not every agadah is meant to be taken literally. So the Ramban wrote, so first he said, I don't believe that. So they said, what do you mean you don't believe it? It's in your book. So he said, I'll tell you what I mean. I mean that it's an agadah, and not every agadah has to be taken literally. This is what it said. If you remember in the Latin document, it said that he claimed that the sermons were lies. So it's not that he claimed that they were lies, but he said that they're not always meant to be taken literally. And in fact, he uses the expression that is yesh la pirush acher misisrei hachamim, that this medrash, it has a pirush acher misisrei hachamim. Now, I used to think that what he meant by that line was simply that nothing necessarily meant anything specific, but just that it's a metaphor for something. I mean, just like as a mashal. You know, if I'm learning that medrash, so, you know, and the medrash says that this Arab came and told him your temple was destroyed, and then a minute later he said your Messiah was born, it means something about how even at the darkest times there's always hope, you know, there's always hope. Maybe it means something like that. So I used to think that maybe the Ramban meant something along those lines. It recently became clear to me that the Ramban actually meant something very specific and was very deliberate that he called it Misisrei Hachamim, Pirush Acher Misisrei Hachamim, which he didn't want to share. The Rakanti in Parshas Vayeshev brings that medrash, and he brings it in the course of a discussion about whether the neshama of Mashiach is a chadasha or not. Now, what does that mean, a chadasha? So what he's talking about over there is the idea of souls being reincarnated, and which was an idea that comes from the Mekubalim. In the, I'll call it classic sources in Yiddishkeit, there's no makor for such an idea. It comes from the Mekubalim. The Rakanti was definitely from that school, and he's talking about how there are often Gilgulim in Neshamais. And he says, and he brings a debate about whether the Neshama of Mashiach is going to be a Gilgul or is going to be a Neshama Chadasha. And he says that these Midrashim and Chazals that talk about Mashiach having been around at some point in history, what it means is the Neshama of Mashiach. Because the Neshama Mashiach could go through various Gilgulim, and then not everybody holds that way, but if you hold that the Mashiach is going to be Gilgul, so that's the pshat in these Gemaras. Now,
I don't understand the proof from the Gemara. It's the Arab that said it. So what kind of proof is that?
Okay, I hear. Chazal telling the story. So he thought that they found it significant. The Arab was probably just a character that was put into the for the telling of the story. Now, The Ramban wrote a Pirush on Chumash. The Ramban in the 1200s, the 50s, 60s, he died in the year 1270. He was writing a Pirush on Chumash in which he included passages that are Alpi Kabbalah, that are from, you know, mystical parts of the Torah. When he's writing about the mitzvah of Yibum, he says that Yibum, he's really writing about it primarily in Bereishis by Yehuda and Tamar, and he says that it's a soid misoides hatayra or misisrei hatayra having to do with the tchunas hanefesh, and I can't share anymore. That's what he says. Now, in the first Sheher Ramban, they all say that what he means to be referring to is the idea of Gilgulim, and that the Yibum is that the nefesh of the brother that died is Nizgalgel in the firstborn from the Yibum union. But the Ramban didn't speak it out. The Ramban just said that there's a Soyid mi Sisre Hatayro mi Soyidis Hatayro. The Ramban wrote a Pirush on Sefer Iyav, in which, now Iyav is all about the mystery of Rosh HaVatayv L'Tzadik V'Ra'aloi. And the Ramban says, you'll find this in Perek Lamed Gimel, he's going through certain psukim and he says that these psukim are, you know, trying to address and explore the difficulty of Tzadik V'Ra'aloi. Then he says, but if you want to know the deeper pshat in these psukim, and which is also the truer answer and the real answer to this question, you'll have to look at the king and the bride, the HaMelech V'Hakala, and the Tomei Tzviya, and the twin deer, which is a very, very cryptic remark. I wouldn't figure out on my own what it is, but the footnotes on the bottom, Rav Chevel wrote footnotes on the Kisvei HaRamban, and he says, and I think it's pretty clear that there's other references in that paragraph also, that HaMelech means Yehuda, and HaKala is Tamar, who was the daughter-in-law of Yehuda. And the Tomei Tzviya refers to Peretz and Zerach, who were the Toimim that were born at that time. And he means to say that you look into that parasha and you'll discover the answer, the deeper answer to the question of Tzadik V'Ra'aloi, Rosh HaVatayv L'Ai. What am I getting at? My point is that the Ramban, in a few places in his writings in Torah, alluded to the concept of Gilgal, but only very, very elliptically, very, you know, he never spoke it out. Because apparently at that time, this was considered such a big secret in this from the Sisrei HaTorah, the only people who were really, you know, schooled in Soides HaTorah, in the Torah HaSoid, were familiar with it, and you weren't allowed to share it with other people. And he didn't want to write it in a way that was clear enough for me and you to understand. Now, it seems strange because nowadays, everybody's heard of this. I mean, you go to Pirkei as a child and you hear, you know, Baal Shem Tov stories about how the farmer was really a Gilgal of Eliyahu HaNavi or whatever, or the Tzaddik was really a Gilgal of the farmer. And, you know, and the in the Kisvei Arizal, he writes so much about, you know, different figures in Chazal being Gilgulim of different figures in Tanakh. There's a lot of such things in the Kisvei Arizal. Obviously, I only know it from secondhand, third-hand sources, But it's, you know, we've all heard such things. The idea that Judaism believes in Gilgulim doesn't take people by surprise nowadays. But in the 1200s, this was considered a very deep side. You see from the Ramban al HaTorah that he was not about to share it even with you and me. Al HaChama V'Chama, he was not about to share it in the king's palace. But that's the real pshat. That's what the Ramban, the Rakanti is mi-beis midrash shel Ramban. If the Rakanti told us, he's a two doyris after the Ramban, but he's, I think, a Talmud of the, I think of the Rashba, I'm not sure, but he's considered me Talmidim of the Ramban, and he definitely, you know, was very, very strongly influenced by the Teres Ramban. And if he says that the pshat in this Gemara, the Medrash and Eicha, about Mashiach being born the day that the Beis Midrash was destroyed, is really a reference to the neshama of Mashiach in a prior Gilgal. So he probably got that from the Ramban. That was the, or from the Beis Medrash of the Ramban. And the Ramban knew that was the pshat, but he couldn't say it. That's why he said over here, he said, you know, first he said, maybe it's not true, right, because we don't take all Midrashim literally. And maybe it's just, it's Misistri Hatera, which was a reference to this pshat that he wasn't going to share with them. So he says, so that's why he started off by saying, you know, I don't believe this. Meaning, as a literal matter, that Mashiach was really born on the day the Beis Medrash was destroyed, I don't believe that. But remember the second half of that dramatic statement that he made. He said, I don't believe it, but if it's true, it's a proof to me, not to you. So they said, what do you mean? So he said, well, obviously, if Mashiach was born the day the Beis Medrash was destroyed, so if it proves one thing, it proves that Yeshua was not Mashiach. Because Yeshu was before the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. And then he throws in a little bit of a dig. He says Yeshu was about 150 years before the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, except according to your cheshbon, he was 73 years because you have the wrong cheshbon about your history. But that's a reference to the fact. And I don't know quite why he says 73. I mean, the way that we usually... Can, he, in our version, it says over here 73. The way that we usually count a Churban Bayis Sheni is supposed to be in the year 70, or I've seen it as the year 68 or the year 70. I don't know. Okay, let's say around the year 70.
What's their proof that the Yeshua was born after the Beis Mikdash?
No, they don't. They don't. They say that Yeshua goes to the year zero, right? They're counting 2023 or 1263 at that time from Yeshua.
Beis Mikdash was 70
years later. And Beis Mikdash was destroyed, and if it was in the year 70, so it doesn't work with their dates. But he threw in this dig that. And in your year zero, you're counting your 1,263 years from what? From Yeshua. Yeshua wasn't at that time. Because it says in the Talmud that he was a Talmud of Rabbi Shuman Prachia. Rabbi Shuman Prachia was from the Zugites before Hillel. Hillel was 100 years before Churban Bayis Sheni. And this is a couple of days before Hillel. So he approximates it as 150 years. So that's just an aside, that your dates are off, right? You don't know the history of Christianity. We know the history of Christianity. But be that as it may, he says Yeshua definitely was not born when the Beis Mikdash was destroyed. So what do you mean to prove from this Medrash? So they said, well, but at least to prove that Mashiach already came a long time ago, and that's like us and not like you. So Ramban says, okay, it shouldn't do you that much good if it means that it's, you know, that it's some other guy was the Messiah. But okay, but then when he was pushed against the wall, that he has to respond to that. So he said, well, you know what? All it says in this piece is that he was born. It doesn't say that he came. They said, what do you mean? He was born. He said, well, look at the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Did the Yidden leave Mitzrayim at that time? Were they free? Was there a geula because Moshe Rabbeinu was born? When Moshe Rabbeinu came to Paroi and said, Shlach Ami, so then there was a geula. So then he says, Mashiach was born. That doesn't really do anything. When Mashiach will come before the Pope and say, Shalach Ami, then we could say that there is a Geula. Which, again, was a very bold thing to say, that in this audience to compare the Pope to the Paroi of the biblical story. But that's what he said. So then he said, that's how I deal with that Gemara. Now, that does seem a little bit weak. Right? Let's leave that on hold for a moment. That he's saying, okay, he was born, but he didn't come, but it was a long time ago. Let's put that on hold. They brought another source. Now, this is a more well-known one, because this is actually a Gemara in the Talmud Bavli. This is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, I think, but I'm actually not sure, where it says there, Shuman Levi met Eliyahu HaNavi, and he said, when is Masai Asi Mashiach? When is Mashiach coming? And Eliyahu HaNavi told him, why don't you go ask him? So he said, ask him, where is he? Eliyahu HaNavi said, he's at the gates of Rome. So then the Gemara says, Rabbi Shimon Levi traveled to Rome, and he went over to Mashiach, and he said, Masli Asi Mar, when is Mar coming? And Mashiach said, Hayoim, today. And he said, today? And then he said, Hayoim Mibukol Tishmau. And that's the end of the post like that. Yeah, the post says, Hayoim Mibukol Tishmau. So that's what I mean by Hayoim. That's the Gemara. Now, this is but this Gemara, again, like that Medrash, it shows that Mashiach was already around hundreds of years ago. So again, that the Jews think that they're still waiting for Mashiach, and this proves that Christianity is right. But this Gemara is particularly geschmack for the perspective of people like Pablo Christiani, because not only does it say that Mashiach was around centuries earlier, but it puts him in Rome. Rome, you know, he doesn't get any better than that for the Catholic Church. So, you know, there's a piece in the Talmud saying that Mashiach came and he's in Rome. So, Mamish, you know, it's Rachel Bitcha Katana, that they have the true religion. So the Ramban said that, you know, first of all, again, you know, he said, you're showing me a Gemara where Eliyahu HaNavi, where Shimon Levi was asking, when is Mashiach coming? So that means that he hadn't come yet. Shimon Levi was way after Yeshua. He hadn't come yet. So, but he was asking Mashiach. So the man says, okay, so that means, again, like I said before, that he was born, but he didn't come. So at this point, you know, the Ramban keeps on saying this, but it seems very mysterious that, yeah, he was born, but he didn't come. So the king himself jumps in and he says, what do you mean when you say he was born, but he didn't come? I mean, these texts were written 1,000 years ago. So, if that's true, he'd be 1,000 years old. So the Ramban says, okay, Mr. Shalach lived almost that long, and Hachayim Lakel, you know, God grants life. So the king said, first actually the Ramban said, whoa, you're not supposed to be talking here. That was one of the rules that the king is it because, you know, I can't answer a king, you know, his majesty. So one of the rules was that the king's not allowed to talk. But the king couldn't hold himself back when the Ramban was saying, yeah, he was born where he didn't come. So he jumped up and he said, the Ramban said, yeah, you're not allowed to talk now, but okay, fine, I'll answer you. And he said, he was born where he didn't come, he's 1,000 years old. Okay, yeah, God can make somebody live 1,000 years. So the king said, so where is he? So the Ramban said, how am I supposed to know? You have horsemen and soldiers, go make a search party and maybe you'll find him. He said, and he raised, yeah, I said that like as a joke. And that was the end of day one, the first session of the debates. So in that session, the Ramban scored a few nice points, but he does end off like on kind of weak footing on this thing about he was born but he didn't come. I mean, the Ramban said, I'm not meshubit to these midrashim, but if I'm forced to defend them, I'll say that he was born but he didn't come. But that was left kind of as a weak point. In the second session, the Ramban returns to it, and he says, let me explain better what I meant by that. He says, you know, Jews and Christians both agree that there was something called, a major, major event in history called the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. And that changed everything, that ruined everything. And Jews and Christians both agree that B'mayisa Mashiach, all of the kilkul that happened by the Chet of the Eitz Hadas is supposed to become rectified. So I think it's mistaber that if after Mashiach actually comes, so the effects of the Eitz Hadas will become rectified, so even before Mashiach comes, but for Mashiach himself, for the individual who is Mashiach, he is not subject to the effects of the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. If when he comes and is revealed, he's going to rescue the whole world from the effects of the Chet of the Eitz Hadas, so I would like to propose a chiddush that maybe he was never subjected to the effects of the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. If that's true, so then two things. First of all, if there was no Chet of the Eitz Hadas, so man would have lived forever, or at least a very long time. Adam lived 930 years, and that was after he was told, B'yamachalcham amenu tamus. So had he not eaten from the Eitz Hadas, presumably he would have lived thousands of years or forever. The Ramban seems mesupik about that, whether it would be thousands of years or forever, but one or the other. So if that's true, then if there is somebody called Mashiach, it's mistaber that if he was born 1,000 years ago, he would still be alive. So it's not stam that I'm making up, well, you know, God could do anything. But no, it's mistaper that he would live thousands of years. And to your question of where is this man that's thousands of years old, right? Because that was really like a time, like, you know, we would know about such a person. If there's a man that's 1,000 years old, we would know about him. So Ramban said, well, where would we all be if not for the Chet of the Eitz Hadas? We'd be Bereishis. We'd be in Gan Eden. Where is that? Okay, that's a tough question. That's something that people have been working on and wondering about for a long time. But there's somewhere on earth that we haven't really found. It's behind the La Atacher Vamesapeches. That's called Gan Eden. So if that's where we would all be, if not for the Chet of the Eitz Hadas, then Mashiach, who's not subject to the effects of the Chet of the Eitz Hadas, he should still be there. So that's your answer. He's still alive and he's in Gan Eden. And when it's the time for the Geula, he'll come and he'll rescue the world. But all these Gemaras that refer to the fact that Mashiach was born, if you can insist on taking them literally, that's the pshat. There's nothing shver about it. So, okay, so they said, all right, they heard. Then the Ramban says, you know, but what I was just talking about, that Jews and Christians both believe that when Mashiach comes, the kilkul that happened by the Chet of the Eitz Hadas is supposed to become rectified. Doesn't that put you in a pickle? Because the psukim say that because of the Chet of the Eitz Hadas, so there's pain during childbirth. There's, you know, you have to work hard to make a living. Sometimes the earth doesn't produce the crops so well. And if all that's supposed to go away when Mashiach comes, and your team says the Mashiach came already, so what do you do with that? So here again, the king jumped in, because he thought this was like a real softball question, even though he wasn't a trained theologian, but every Christian who went to Sunday school knows the answer to that one, because yeah, it's not when what Mashiach fixed was not those punishments that are written over there, but when Adam ate from the tree of life, so there was something called eternal damnation, which means that all people were going to have to go to Gehenna because of that Avera. Until Yeshu came along, and he fixed the whole thing. He saved mankind, and the salvation is that now if you believe in him, you're spared from that punishment. That's how we were taught how Yeshu Mashiach was Mesakein the Chet Adai Sadas. So the Ramban says, we have an expression where we come from that says, Haretzel L'Shaker Yarchik Edov. If you want to tell a lie, you keep the witnesses far away. And so, for example, if I want to say that today I saw a Martian with three heads, and whenever he talked, the speech bubble came out of his mouth, and I saw him, so I could say that I saw him getting out of a spaceship in the parking lot over here at, what is this, 720 Stewart Avenue? 700, what?
711.
711 Stewart Avenue. I could say I saw him in the parking lot over here. Then you would all know right away that I'm lying, because you've been here all morning, and if that was going on in the parking lot, you would have seen it. So, but if I say I was riding the Q46 on Main Street, and this Martian was sitting next to me, so then you have no way of disproving it. You still might suspect that it's not true because it doesn't seem so credible, but you couldn't disprove it. So that's a much better way to tell the story. Right? You say it in a way that can't be disproven. So the Ramban says that, don't you see that that's what you're doing? Here, you know, you have Pesukim and Bereishis that are abundantly clear about what was supposed to happen as a result of the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. V'zeis ha'pechatoich ha'lachem, be'etzav te'il libonim, k'etz v'dardet atzmiach lach, el ha'ofer tashuv. And all of those, which you're really not in a position to fix, so you say, oh, no, that's not what it's talking about. You made up some other punishment that's not written there about all the souls going to Gehenna, and you said, that's the one that he fixed. Why? Because that's the one that nobody could check. So, and then he adds in, again, he's very sarcastic in this whole thing, and he adds in, he says, I recommend that you send somebody from your team straight to Gehenna to come back and tell us if it's really true that the believers in Yeshu don't have to go there. So he says that's it's really pathetic. What you know, the way you explain this whole inyan of the Chet Adai Sadas, it's a classic Haretzel L'Shaker Yarchik Edav. But then in the second half of that paragraph, he says something which I think is very, very yesodistic. He also said, meaning this first part was just polemics, you know, like good debating skills. The second half is really Torah. In the second half, he says, and besides, I can't accept what you guys say about the Chet Adai Sadas bringing the result called damnation, that all the souls have to go to Gehenna, because that's not fair. Chalila Lakel, he says, I don't believe that a just God would make me go to Gehenna because my grandfather Adam did an Avera. Now, this is a subtle point over here, because obviously you'll say, well, he has to defend that regardless, because it does say that B'zeis Pechatoich HaLechem was a result of the Chet Adai Sadas, even, and I didn't do that there, why do I have to suffer that consequence? So the Ramban says, he says that, you know, we're all made up of two parts. There's a guf and there's a neshama. The guf has biology. Guf has reproduction. There's a father and a mother. A child comes from parents. So if you want to tell me that Hashem was geyser, a change in the biology of man to make him mortal, to make childbirth difficult, so it may not be fair, but it's natural. It follows that if that happened to Adam and Chava, that's going to happen to all of mankind, because biologically we descend from them. Our guf comes from them, so our physical natures are going to come from them. But neshamos, Zakhtar Ramban, there's no parentage in neshamos. He expresses it with a very extreme statement. He says, my neshama is no more related to my father's than it is to the neshama of Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Neshama, there's no relations in neshamas. There's no parents, children, siblings. Each neshama comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we're not related. So my neshama doesn't come from Adam and Chava. So if Adam and Chava got a punishment in their neshama that they should go to Gehenna, that there's no reason why that should affect me. And to go send my neshama to Gehenna for their Avera, that's what he's setting up with me for. So therefore the Ramban says that as in Jewish theology, I could accept that we suffer the b'zeis ha'pachatoich alechem as a result of the chet ha'isadas, but not going to Gehenna as a result of the chet ha'isadas. Now this is a chiddush, and this is a dvar Torah from the Ramban that is, I don't think we have elsewhere, but it's a nice yisoid. And I think it comes as a surprise sometimes to people that what he says that each neshama and neshamas are really unrelated. Not just a surprise to people. I think there are makoyres that talk about a collective neshama of Klal Yisrael, and the Jews are somehow all related in their neshama to one another. This Ramban, I think, is saying not like that. This Ramban is saying that I'm no more related to my father than I am to Paro Melech Mitzrayim. So it's a very strong statement. Okay. I guess we're not going to go through so much more of the debate. We'll just take another couple of minutes. I'm going to jump to the ending. At the end, the Ramban says that if you remember in the, there was this piece over here in the Latin document where he said that a friar Dianowa had told him that he should stop, and then Friar Dianowa refuted that, and then he was shown that he was a liar. So in his version, what it says is that this important galach came to him. He told the king that we really should stop the debate, because the galachim, and he mentioned this particular galach by name, came and told him that it's really very bad for their congregations to be witnessing this, because you're giving them kashas that we're not going to be able to answer for the next 100 years. So I'd like this to be ended. But he said that to the Ramban privately, and then the king addressed him publicly, and he said, "Do you demand that we stop the debate?" And clearly the king was displeased. So he said, "Whatever your Majesty wants." So that's what actually happened with. But then they agreed that the last session, the third session, should be held behind closed doors. It was a private session. At the end of the debate, the king said to the Ramban that, okay, we're going to end it here. And he had a line, a classic line. He said, if I can find it, I'll read it to you in the original. Yeah. Le'ra'isi adam she'en hadin imoi she'ton oisoi yofe ka'asher asisa. The king said, in English, I never saw somebody defend a wrong cause as ably as you did. Which is basically what he's saying is, I'm not about to say that Judaism is the true religion. Right. All I'll say is, it sure sounds that way when I hear you talk, Rabbi. So that's what the king said. Then there was a little bit of a drama after that. The king gave him that compliment, and he also gave him some money, in recognition of his brilliant performance, and he said goodbye. So he's supposed to leave Barcelona, the capital, and go back home to Girona. He heard in the palace on the grapevine that the king's plan was that the following Shabbos, he was going to come, he himself, together with some galachim, were going to come to the shul in Barcelona. They had to somehow, they felt that there was a lot of damage done over these last days. So they were going to come to the shul in Barcelona and give a little speech about, once the Ramban was out of the way, give a little speech about Christianity, about the truth of their faith, and about the Trinity, and all that. So the Ramban decided he's going to stay in town, but incognito. Uh-huh. And he came to shul the next Shabbos, and he was sitting there, like a regular, he was sitting somewhere in the back, and the king, apparently without realizing that the Ramban was there, he got up and he gave a whole long speech. And then the Ramban got up after him.
Oh.
And he said, and he said to the king, his majesty's words are always excellent and honorable and praiseworthy. After all, they're coming from the mouth of somebody who is himself excellent and honorable and praiseworthy. In fact, I would praise your words with all possible praise, with the exception of that they're true.
With the exception of saying
that they're true. That's the only praise that I won't give. He's talking to the king, right? So he has to be very, very, you know, proper and respectful. But with the exception of saying that they're true. And then he went on to say that the ending over here is a discussion about the Trinity. You'll remember that in the Latin document it said that the Ramban had once agreed that the Trinity was a true idea. So there's a whole dialogue here where he says that he once had in the past this conversation with Pablo Casciani, and he said, when you say that there's a Trinity, do you mean that there's three gods? No, I don't mean that there's three gods. Do you mean that God has three souls? No, I don't mean that God has three souls. He says, so do you mean that he's made up of three different elements? No, I don't mean that. Okay, so what do you mean? Well, so he says, the Trinity is ha-chochma v'ha-chefetz v'ha-yecholes. Okay, wisdom, will, and omnipotence.
Ability.
That's the Trinity. So man says, okay, well, I agree that God is wise. I agree that God has will. I agree that God is omnipotent. So, okay, we could agree on that. That was the agreement that he gave to the Trinity. And then at the end, he got embarrassed. He said, no, that's not what I mean. That's what I mean. And finally he said, this Pablo Casciani said, what I mean is something that I shouldn't even have to explain this to you, a mere mortal. It's so deep that even the heavens of on high can't understand it. So Ramban said back, okay, so that makes the heavens on, the angels. The angels on high can't understand it. So he said, so I guess that means that the angels on high are not fans of the Trinity, neither are we. So good. So they're on our team. That's his ending. That was his ending. All right.
MB said she didn't get the dollar sign.